First Lady. Her stance as Secretary of State that the 2011 Russian parliamentary elections had been rigged. Important backstory for the argument she was now trying to make about Russian meddling in the U.S. election. I could even drop references to the first time Hillary ordered room service. She was a Goldwater girl staying at the Fontainebleau Hotel on Miami Beach to see Richard Nixon nominated at the 1968 Republican National Convention. I hoped this context, my up-close observations of Hillary, her aides, her supporters, her reception in black churches and inner cities and steel towns that she'd zip in and out of, would help readers feel like they better understood this unknowable being. That they could walk into the voting booth on election day a little more informed about their choice. If we really do all have a part to play in this messy, mesmerizing process that every 4 years alters the course of the country, then my mental trove of Hillary trivia and hammering out words on a rickety tray table on a refurbished 737 was mine. The cough started in Luke Eastern Park on Kinsman Road in a black area of Cleveland. "Hey, Cleveland, happy, happy Labor Day," Hillary said, letting out the first phlegmy whopper. "When we were trying to figure out where we could be, we all said, 'Let's go to Cleveland.'" Her voice cracked. She coughed again. 5, 6, 7, 8 times. She reached under the podium and took a sip of water. Campaign staffers winced. Voters looked at each other with clenched jaws. Somebody started a lukewarm chant of "Hillary," but Hillary, now in a full coughing fit, put her hand up to silence the crowd. She convulsed and patted her chest with her hands a few times, a prayer for this to pass. "I've been talking so much," she started, but she couldn't finish. Thing was, Hillary hadn't been talking that much. She'd spent the last couple of weeks talking remarkably little. She unwrapped a honey-flavored Halls and managed to joke, "Every time I think about Trump, I get allergic." But it came out more like an extended wheeze. The coughing attack pained me. Yes, Hillary was extremely pissed at me that day, but she didn't deserve this. She didn't deserve to spend 16 months on the road only to play into all the conspiracies about her health. The Drudge Report led with a photo of Hillary's head cocked back mid-cough with the headline, "Choke, more pain on plane," and 8 accompanying stories, including 10 doctors question Hillary health, media blame pollen, and the requisite complete timeline of 2016 coughing fits. The next day, Hillary came to the back of the plane to tell us that twice a year, in the spring and the fall, when the pollen comes out, her allergies flare up. "I just upped my antihistamine to try to break through it," she said. "It lasts a couple of days and then it disappears." Drudge was right. I wanted to blame it on pollen. I wrote a lighthearted blog post about Hillary's allergies in which I compared conservative media's innuendo about her health to conspiracies about Obama's birth certificate. I quoted Hillary telling us, "I have created so many jobs in the sort of conspiracy theory machine factory, because honestly, they never quit." But Hillary was clearly sick. 4 days after the Labor Day crew, she clutched onto the lectern at the New York Historical Society and said in a frail, diminutive voice, "I believe that America's national security must be top priority for our next president." I was sitting in the front row a few feet away. By then, I knew it wasn't pollen. Hillary had drowsy eyes and the reduced presence of a person who had popped a handful of extra-strength Tylenol when they should be in bed. 3 hours later, at an LGBT for Hillary fundraiser in the cavernous ballroom of Cipriani in Lower Manhattan, Barbra Streisand sang a Trump-themed parody of Send in the Clowns. "Is he that rich? Maybe he's poor. Till he reveals his returns, who can be sure? Who needs this clown?" Laverne Cox introduced Hillary, and she walked on stage in front of a blue velvet curtain to a standing ovation. She acted loopy from the start. "Wow, thank you, thank you. It's sort of like the 7th inning stretch," Hillary said, resting her hands on the clear lucite podium. You know, I've been saying at events like this lately, I am all that stands between you and the apocalypse. Tonight, I'm all that stands between a much better outcome. It got worse. Forgetting that the campaign allowed the press pool to cover her remarks, Hillary did her usual bit about the baskets. But like the 3D printer that, the more times she said it, moved in Hillary's mind from Waterloo to Moline, the three baskets of Trump voters had somehow become two. You know, just to be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables, Hillary said, pausing for comedic emphasis. Right? Am I right, folks? Babs was said to have cringed backstage. The guys tried the clean-up in aisle 7 approach. They explained that Hillary's comments weren't any different from what she'd been saying all along about the racism Trump's campaign has fueled. By 2:06 p.m. the next day, Hillary issued a statement saying she regretted that she'd said half. Podesta released his own statement saying Trump has spent 15 months insulting nearly every group in America, and that this is without a doubt deplorable, but this is who he is. After the convention, donors asked Brooklyn what they planned to do to pull Hillary's trust numbers out of the toilet. The answer was always the same. Nothing. Podesta would explain, I remember when no one trusted Bill Clinton and he won twice. That was true, but Slick Willie was different. Voters may not have trusted Clinton with their daughters, but they trusted that he was looking out for them. That wasn't the case with Hillary, and laughing at tens of millions of Americans while surrounded by her rich, fabulous, urbane friends at a fundraiser at Cipriani wasn't going to help. I really messed up, she told aides that night. On Sunday morning, Hillary arrived at Ground Zero to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, and I dragged Bobby to a flywheel class. Despite his cultural aversion to healthy food and light beer, Bobby is slim, with broad shoulders and legs so long they stretch the length of our L-shaped sofa. I didn't usually have the time or energy to do much marital nagging, but with the election in sight, I had visions about the active weekend routines we'd soon adopt. With Hillary at the September 11th memorial service and the press pool keeping an eye on her, I had a free morning to lure my husband to a spin class. Come on, it'll be fun, I said the night before. I sat on the chaise we bought at the room and board clearance sale that overlooked Seward Park and that I hardly ever had a chance to lay in. Lately, whenever I looked out at the trees and the squirrels, I thought of Hillary. It wasn't enough that we lived on Clinton Street, but our second-floor apartment overlooked Seward Park. Hillary had been telling donors that William Seward was her favorite Secretary of State. He was, after all, a senator from New York who ran for president, lost to an eloquent up-and-coming politician from Illinois, and then surprised everyone by serving as his former rival Secretary of State. Bobby sat on the sofa. Can we just go to brunch? He said. I knew Bobby didn't want to spin when he proposed brunch, a New York activity that for him ranks right above dragging an AC unit home from PC Richard. We can go to brunch after, I said. I've never been spinning before, Bobby said. It's so easy. I'll show you how to set up the bike and everything. Okay, he said without turning around. But I want to be in the back row. We'd rented our cycling shoes and were heading into the studio when I looked at Twitter one last time before tuning out for a whole 45 minutes. Oh my God, I said. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. People were staring. I stopped in the doorway and caused a pileup of girls in sports bras. What is it? Bobby said, scooting me over a few inches. Our cycling shoes clinked. Hillary passed out. She passed out. I've got to go. I'm sorry, I said. You'll be great. I kissed him and unvelcroed my shoes without sitting down. As I raced out of the studio, the redhead behind the counter who heard my breakdown yelled, We've got some zinc pills here if your friend Hillary needs them. No thanks, I said. She's good. But my friend Hillary was anything but good. I sat on a bench at Astor Place and watched and rewatched the video a passerby shot of Hillary's legs giving out, her limp body being hoisted into her Scooby van. It looked like one of those Hillary's health hoax videos assembled in Matt Drudge's basement. I ran the footage by hired gun guy to make sure it wasn't fake. Half of me hoped that it was. Brown Loafers, after not confirming whether Hillary had even left the memorial, put out a statement saying she felt overheated so departed to go to her daughter's apartment and is feeling much better. It wasn't his fault. Hillary only told Huma and Cheryl about the pneumonia diagnosis she got on Friday. Hillary was on her way to Chelsea's apartment in the Flatiron District when the unsolicited texts from sources started flooding in. Number one, where does the person go who has been shot in the robbery? Never to the hospital. Number two, this is a disaster. Number three, she said she was fine and was hiding her true health. Number four, Heard Secret Service made her wear heavy body armor. Number five, and later that afternoon from my mom, I hope Hillary didn't give you pneumonia. David Axelrod tweeted the primo question, antibiotics can take care of pneumonia. What's the cure for an unhealthy penchant for privacy that repeatedly creates unnecessary problems? Bobby walked out of the class like he'd spent the day horseback riding, his shirt glued to his chest. Hi, how was it? I'm really sorry, but I'm on deadline now. He sat on the bench next to me and took a long swig of water without speaking. The good news is brunch is out, I said. He took a couple more sips and, squinting into the traffic, said, how's Hillary? Chapter 45, The Fall of Magical Thinking. On board the campaign plane, September 2016. The Clementine crushed any hopes we had that the Stronger Together plane would lead to Hillary wandering back to schmooze with us. After a couple of unsuccessful tries, Ruby Kramer rolled the fruit up the aisle and into the front cabin. We'd written on its peel the question, would you rather have dinner with Trump or Putin? The travelers waited anxiously until the Clementine came whirling back down with Putin circled. We tweeted out Hillary's response. That's when Brown Loafers came back and informed us that the Clementine had been off the record. He said he'd circled Putin, not Hillary. The debate went like this. But you never said the orange was off the record. It's a Clementine, Brown Loafers said. You don't have a case. Everyone is really tense, Brown Loafers said, shaking his head. The campaign won. The embeds tweeted out a clarification. HRC saw the orange, noted she once dined with Putin, but did not issue an answer either way. It was not lost on the more senior reporters that Ruby Kramer, whose father, Richard Ben Kramer, had revolutionized access journalism and been so close with sources that Biden spoke at his memorial service in 2013, was rolling an orange, sorry, a clementine, up the aisles trying to get something, anything, out of Hillary. On one stop, Hillary came to the back of the plane to prove how much she appreciated her young staffers. How's Arun treating you? Arun goes all the way back to the State Department with me, don't you? How many years has it been, Arun? Hillary said, singling out our blushing, bushy-haired press wrangler, who almost always wore a jacket and tie. We were all too polite to tell her that his name was Varun. Hillary popped into the press cabin, freshly shellacked and ready to get the televised, I'm feeling great, exchange over with. Hi, guys. Welcome back to Stronger Together, she said. Andrea Mitchell took the first stab. How are you doing? How are you feeling? I'm doing great. Thank you so much, Hillary said. Imagine two cars stuck in third gear. Each is being pushed up opposite sides of a hill, but just before they get to the top and can see each other, they keep sliding back down the hill. That's what it's like trying to make on-the-record small talk with Hillary. She promised us she'd take our questions after a speech in Greensboro, and when she started to turn away, a traveler yelled, "What have you been doing for the last few days?" I will talk about that later, too, Hillary said, still on the move. I said the first thing that came to mind. Did you binge-watch The Good Wife? It's done. I am so sad. I really am. It's really a loss, Hillary said. She stopped and turned, lingering over the flash of cameras. Madam Secretary, however, is coming back, so that's something to look forward to. Is that odd to watch? It's so meta, I asked. I actually get a big kick out of it, Hillary said. Yeah, I guess seeing Tia Leone play you, I said. I watched it with a little bit of skepticism at first, but I got so into it, I really like the storylines. They have some good quasi-realistic storylines, so anyway. Why North Carolina? A TV correspondent yelled. Excited to get to North Carolina, Hillary said. She gave a clumsy half-thumbs up and headed to the front cabin. Bye, a couple of us muttered. Looking out the window from the motorcade at the relaxed, abundantly green blur of Greensboro, North Carolina, I wanted to spend more than an hour there. But the days when we actually got to know a place ended a long time ago. The campaign was surgical at this point. Get in at this church in Durham or that community college in South Florida and get out. Hillary walked onto the stage to James Brown's I Got You, I Feel Good, with such aplomb that conspiracy theorists thought she had a body double. At the press conference following the rally, it was Hillary, all right. I sat cross-legged on the wooden floor of the basketball court, half listening. My deadline was approaching, and my editor emailed me, I need a top, which meant I had to get at least 200 words to him. Hillary agreed to take questions, mostly to prove how much stamina she had, but as soon as she exhaled and opened her three-ring folder on the podium in front of us, she seemed only half herself. She told the rally that the 3 days at home resting had been a gift that allowed her to reconnect with what this whole campaign is about. This reassured me since I still didn't know what the campaign was about. The race was pretty much tied at this point. Outside, a cluster of protesters held handmade posters with the usual Hillary for prison, plus a newer rallying cry, I am deplorable. Hillary spoke softly and with minimal animation. I want to give Americans something to vote for, not just against, she said. I want to close my campaign focused on opportunities for kids and fairness for families. That's been the cause of my life. It will be the passion of my presidency. That sounded good, but Hillary must have still been on heavy medication if she thought she could make the rest of an election against Trump about the detailed plans in 38 different policy areas that she'd laid out over the past year and a half. Instead, she would spend much of the fall deriding Trump for his fat shaming of a former Miss Universe and defending Rosie O'Donnell, who she called an accomplished actor, and Kim Kardashian against Trump's pathetic put-downs. Hillary got irritated with us even faster than usual. When the travelers asked several times about why she hadn't told Tim Kaine about her pneumonia diagnosis on Friday and what does that say about what your relationship would be like with him in the White House, she said, we communicated, but I'm not going to go into our personal conversations. Asked why it took so long for the press and the public to know, Hillary blamed Brooklyn. My campaign has said that they could have been faster, and I agree with that. I certainly expect them to be as focused and quick as possible. The only problem with that excuse, of course, was that her campaign didn't know. Chuck Schumer, who'd been next to Hillary at the September 11th memorial service, later said he'd had pneumonia too. The virus became a status symbol of physical proximity to the next president. Carolyn joked, did you see that Jennifer Granholm and Chris Quinn infected themselves with pneumonia bacteria so they can announce they have it like Schumer did? Like most of the press, I considered Hillary's handling of her pneumonia and what it said about her psychology more of a story than any actual health problems. She was 68, and we could hardly keep up with her ourselves. But going back to the Guernica press conference, the biggest fuck-ups of Hillary's campaign were always because of her time warp syndrome. Hillary had the 1990s in mind when she told only Cheryl and Huma about her pneumonia diagnosis. After the September 11th memorial, in the van on the way to Chelsea's apartment, Huma said to Hillary, how does the statement about dehydration square with the pneumonia diagnosis? The rest of the aides in the van looked at each other. What pneumonia diagnosis? During the 2008 primary, whenever critics would accuse Hillary of living in the past, she'd say, what part of the 1990s didn't they like, the peace or the prosperity? She didn't talk about the 90s much in 2016, but everything, from her rallies to TV ads and piles of opposition research and how she handled the pneumonia, came out of the 1992 playbook. Cheryl and Huma, who were with her in the White House, appreciated her zone of privacy. They'd live through Whitewater and Travelgate and all the other gates James Carville loved to recite on cable news. Disclosure didn't ever help matters. Brooklyn often suggested that Hillary try to break out of the 90s mindset, play to her strengths, and cut back on the traditional rallies. Her pint-sized crowds compared to Trump's only fed reporters reductionist theories about enthusiasm anyway. She could do town halls and impromptu stops, aides suggested, like the time she walked into a Girl Scout office in Ashland, Kentucky. I loved being a Girl Scout. I was a Brownie first, then I was a Girl Scout, then I was something called a Mariner Scout when I was in high school, she told the little girls who gathered around her in their green and brown patch-covered sashes. Hillary seemed more at ease, less scripted in these settings, and they always got picked up on the news the same way a rally or speech would, Brooklyn argued. But Huma always insisted that they keep it old school, big or big-ish rallies, TV ads, and above all else, debate prep. Hillary even rehearsed how to create a primetime TV moment like the one her husband had in a 1992 debate when George H.W. Bush checked his watch as Bill had a heartfelt exchange with a woman about the down economy. Hillary would take a couple of steps toward the questioner, make eye contact, empathize. Again, Hillary cut back on her campaign schedule and spent most days preparing for the debate in a conference room at the Doral Arrowwood Resort in Rybrook. Thursday, September 22nd. HRC has no public events scheduled. Friday, September 23rd. HRC has no public events scheduled. Saturday, September 24th. HRC will attend the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Sunday, September 25th. HRC has no public events scheduled. Monday, September 26th. HRC will participate in the presidential debate at Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. I'd been at the office the day Hillary came to the belly of the beast, the New York Times building, to meet with the editorial board. After about an hour of policy talk, Carolyn tried to show Hillary the Times' latest technological innovation, a 360 video camera. A couple of weeks earlier, after Trump met with the editorial board, when he said his proposed border wall was negotiable, he delighted in the funky little multi-lens camera, peeking into its mirrored eye and asking how it works. Hillary looked at Carolyn as if she'd tried to hand her a ticking blob of C4. She took a couple of steps back and called out for her team, Jen, can you take a look at this? Then Hillary turned to Carolyn, the editor who oversees the Times' political coverage, and said, you need to talk to my team about that. Hillary always used debate prep sessions as cathartic exercises. Before the You're Likeable Enough debate in New Hampshire in 2008, Hillary had lost it. She kicked everyone out of the room and sipped hot tea with Chelsea. Aides understood that in order to keep it all together on stage, Hillary sometimes needed to unleash on them in private. You want authentic? Here it is! She'd yelled in one 2016 prep session, followed by a fuck-laced fusillade about what a disgusting human being Trump was and how he didn't deserve to even be in the arena. The Times devoted at least a week's worth of energy into trying to figure out who would play Trump in debate prep. My unsubstantiated guesses had included Andrew Cuomo. It has to be someone Hillary genuinely hates, I'd argued. Or Terry McAuliffe. I felt like an idiot when Maggie Haberman broke that they'd tapped original guy, who later told Annie Carney that he got off his meds for the occasion. Wherever will Hillary find a manipulative, sometimes charming, often hilarious, possible sociopath? Hillary also relied on Ron Klain, a Biden loyalist who had prepped Bill for the I Feel Your Pain moment in 1992. When Pat Healy interviewed Trump around that time and ran some of Hillary's debate prep techniques by him, Trump responded, I don't need to rehearse being human. Chapter 46, Debate Hillary. Long Island, New York, September 26, 2016. The morning of the first general election debate, I slept until 8. I did a hip-hop yoga class in a candlelit 100-degree room and then sat in Seward Park drinking the first of a half a dozen iced coffees I'd ingest over the next 20 hours. Watching the elderly Chinese ladies doing Tai Chi in Seward Park always soothed me. I wanted to join in on their languid arm circles and ninja-like toe pivots, but I worried that I didn't know the moves. A few weeks earlier, I'd asked my friend and neighbor, Martin Wilson, how do they all know exactly what to do? It's like the hokey pokey for them, he said. They just do. Debate day was kind of like that. We had our own rhythms. It starts out quiet. Print reporters typically sleep in, work out, and indulge in a carb-heavy breakfast. By midday, we are gaming out different scenarios and assembling 1,000 words of bee matter, the paragraphs of generic background that we can cut and paste into a story on deadline. A vast, plotting political machine surrounds her, insulates her, and protects her. But Mrs. Clinton is at her most compelling and sympathetic when she is all alone, defending herself in these tense, hard-to-watch moments. Then comes an extended anticipatory period between 4 p.m. and the start of the debate, 8 or 9 p.m. This is when pizza or sub sandwiches arrive in the newsroom and we reach our limit of listening to cable TV pundits. Someone picks up the remote and yells, "Mind if I mute this?" As soon as the candidates walk on the stage, we do not speak. For the next 90 minutes, there is only the occasional yell of, "Did anybody get that line?" and "Can someone send me that exchange?" I arrived at Hofstra University 9 hours before the debate started, which seemed like a reasonable amount of time to check in and make sure the Wi-Fi worked. I found hired gun guy looking telegenic in heavy foundation after an MSNBC hit. Reporters pounced. In my continued misreading of the scrum, I told him my hot yoga pre-debate ritual and asked about Hillary's. I didn't know Hillary's debate day rituals, but I did know something about her workouts. She'd said she does yoga my own way. I once asked if this type of yoga incorporated briefing books. A girlfriend talked her into trying P90X home videos, and Bill told me the previous summer, "Hillary has been working out, regimen in the morning, 6 a.m. in the pool. I thought it was easy, and she made me try it with her." Did Hillary walk her dogs? Did she do yoga? Did she and Bill binge on blueberry pancakes as a debate morning tradition? I asked. "We're not that kind of campaign," hired gun guy said. Hillary knew this was the biggest night of her career. Somebody said to me, "Well, remember, there'll be a lot of people watching, 100 million people watching, and 60 million will be paying attention to the campaign for the first time," Hillary said at a fundraiser in East Hampton. The press had been kept in a basement TV room and could hear her remarks through the ceiling. Hillary was always so insecure after debates. Almost a year earlier, after the first primary debate in Vegas, when Sanders had declared that "the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails," Hillary had appeared so masterfully competent that she'd crushed Biden's lifelong dream in 2 televised hours. She went backstage at the win and asked her team, "How'd I do? Was I okay?" The guys erupted, reassuring her all at once, "Are you kidding? That was unbelievable." There was no real reason for Hillary to doubt herself, aside from the time in 2007 when she gave a yes, no, maybe response to whether she supported giving driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. She almost always killed it. The debate is to Hillary what the handshake is to her husband, what the soaring oratory is to Obama. This preternatural gift went back to high school. A childhood friend, Ernie, Ricky Ricketts, told me about the time Hillary, such a diehard Goldwater girl that she wore a hat with the AUH2O logo, had to play LBJ in a mock debate of the 1964 presidential election. She protested, but eventually pored over Johnson's civil rights, foreign policy, and health care positions, and presented her case with such ardor that by college she'd even convinced herself and became a Democrat. Whenever we would say, "Well, who could speak up for this or that for us?" it was always, "Well, let's get Hillary to do that," Ricketts recalled. I'd covered her in more than 30 of them, and each time I watched her on stage, I felt something almost like pride. In 2007, she'd shown her biting wit, including joking that she was wearing an asbestos pantsuit. She mastered the art of playing the victim. "Maybe we should ask Barack if he's comfortable and needs another pillow," she said in another 2008 primary debate after Saturday Night Live portrayed a coddled Obama in a debate skit. In New Hampshire, she'd earned the sympathy of women voters after the moderator asked about her likability problem. Well, that hurts my feelings, but I'll try to go on, leading to Obama's "you're likable enough" quip. All of those debates seem so inconsequential compared to this one. The first woman nominee on the general election debate stage against a reality TV star renowned for misogyny. Karen Dunn, the petite lawyer and preeminent Democratic debate coach, gave Hillary a fist bump before she went on stage. She reminded her to smile, since viewers would see a split screen while Trump spoke. "I got this," Hillary said. She was right. Hillary won the debate. Hillary won all three of the debates. After the final debate in Vegas, OG hugged Hillary and told her she was a badass hombre. I won't bore you with all the details, because in the end, the debates didn't matter. Our rituals, the times, and Hillary's, our antiquated notion that voters would assess the candidates as we did, failed us. Competence, preparedness, policy. These were words the privileged used. Turned out a lot of people just wanted to blow shit up. The irony was that after the debate, Hillary, for the first time in months, had been cocky. There was none of her usual self-doubt and how'd-I-do's. She hugged aides and donor friends, financiers mostly. She told them that they didn't have to worry anymore. "I will win this," she said. She got the Republican nominee to admit he hadn't paid federal income taxes. "That makes me smart." Shimmied her shoulders, "Woo, okay," in a 5-second burst of humanity that went viral. And she dispensed the trove of opposition research she'd memorized with the sweet precision of a Pez dispenser. But her favorite part of the debate, the moment when she knew she had him, came at the very end. When Trump was asked why he said Hillary didn't have a presidential look, Trump squirmed out of it, pivoting to her lack of stamina. Hillary saw her opening. One of the worst things he said was about a woman in a beauty contest. "He loves beauty contests, supporting them and hanging around them," she said. And he called this woman Miss Piggy. Then he called her Miss Housekeeping because she was Latina. "Donald, she has a name." "Where did you find this? Where did you find this?" Trump said. "Her name is Alicia Machado." 24 hours later, her name was everywhere. Trump spent the next several days fat-shaming Machado. "She gained a massive amount of weight, and it was a real problem," he told Fox News the morning after the debate. Brooklyn arranged a press conference with Machado. They released a string of bilingual Machado-themed ads with footage of Trump dragging the curvaceous Venezuelan to the gym. "This is someone who likes to eat," and sent out guidance so Democrats could blanket the airwaves with Machado talking points. We all agreed with Hillary that Trump must have been unhinged to keep the fight with Machado going. He was self-destructing. We'd taken his earlier declaration, "I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose voters," as a cry for help. But it hadn't been that at all. Each day that Trump handed Hillary ready-made attack ads too delicious for any candidate, especially one focused on women and Latinos, to pass up, was another day Hillary didn't talk about jobs, or health care, or debt-free college. Hillary dropped her promise to give voters something to vote for and not just against. Instead of ending her campaign talking about opportunities for kids and fairness for families, she campaigned with Machado. Tweeted about Machado. Talked about her at rallies. I mean, really, who gets up at 3 a.m. to engage in a Twitter attack against a former Miss Universe? Hillary had consulted over 200 academics and economists to help put together her campaign's policy proposals. A year earlier, at the OTR drinks in New Hampshire, Hillary had berated our pea-sized political brains for being uninterested in policy. Now, Trump had made her as devoid of substance as he was. By the fifth day of Machado-themed programming, the travelers would say, "Donald, she has a name," and somebody would reply, "Her name is Miss Swing State Latina." Chapter 47. How I Became an Unwitting Agent of Russian Intelligence. You could define the beginning of the end as the point when the protagonist has to see that her actions mean something, and that if they don't work out, She is well and truly fucked. Julie Powell, Julie and Julia. New York City, October 2016. The moment you realize that without even knowing it, you've ended up on the wrong side of history. It's dizzying. Months after the election, every time you hear the words Russia and collude, this realization will swirl in your head, enveloping everything. It will be the worst at night. You weren't the only one, but it will sting you the most. And the strange thing is, it started just like any other day. Friday, October 7th, 2016, at 12:15 p.m. Hurricane Matthew barreled up the western Atlantic towards Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. Hillary took a break from debate prep to discuss the storm's trajectory with the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA. That's what presidents do, and Hillary thought that if people could see what kind of president she would be, they'd vote for her. An hour earlier, The Washington Post's David Fahrenholt picked up the phone. The voice on the other end asked if he'd be interested in taking a look at some previously unearthed footage of Trump in a 2005 Access Hollywood video. The Times newsroom had been quiet that afternoon. I'd fed a statement from the campaign on background from an aide to the main story about the hurricane. She noted her commitment to ensuring that FEMA has the tools and resources it needs to both prepare for and respond. I needed to get out by 7 p.m. to meet Bobby for dinner and the Jason Isbell concert. My birthday had been a few weeks back. Bobby, who after a couple of rocky years of odd gifts, a pair of platform sandals he bought at the local shoe repair, had finally adopted my family's opulent observation of every birthday. On any other year, the tickets would have been the perfect gift. I adored the Alabama singer-songwriter. But when I opened the card, I anticipated marital calamity. I thanked him, fighting the urge to yell, "How could you buy me tickets for something a month before the election?" I prayed breaking news wouldn't get in the way. The Post story hit at 4:15 p.m. I heard, "Oh my God," and "Oh God," and "Jesus Christ," float from cubicle to cubicle until my largely agnostic newsroom sounded like a Sunday church choir. We were so paralyzed in disbelief watching the footage of the GOP nominee bragging about sexually assaulting women. "I don't even wait, and when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything," Trump told Billy Bush. "Grab 'em by the pussy." That it took several minutes to set in that the Post had scooped us bigly. This is how men and women are different. The men in the newsroom popped out of their chairs. They discussed the implications of the video. They started scribbling skedlines, brief descriptions of upcoming stories, on Carolyn's whiteboard. A story on the quick rebuke by the GOP establishment. "Is somebody calling Paul Ryan? What impact Pussygate would have on women voters? He just lost more than half the electorate if he hadn't already lost them. The pressure on Trump to drop out. There's no way he can survive this." I stared into my screen, as frozen as the paused image of Trump and Bush stepping off the Access Hollywood bus, the unknowing actress in the fuchsia halter dress waiting to greet them. I thought of the Hillary for America field organizer in Brooklyn who'd harassed his assistant until she begged to be transferred to Colorado. Nobody said anything because senior field organizer was a member of the MOOC mafia, and these things happen on campaigns. I was still in this haze at 4:32 p.m. when WikiLeaks tweeted, "Release the Podesta emails," along with a link to emails from Podesta's Gmail account, including excerpts of Hillary's Wall Street speeches. Fuck. 4:32 p.m. I had 2.5 hours to read through thousands of pages of emails, try to confirm that they were legit, write a story, and answer my editor's questions. 4 hours if I missed our dinner reservation, and I always missed our dinner reservation. I texted Bobby, "Sorry, some breaking news. Meet you at theater. Can't wait." Michael Barbaro and another colleague, Nick Confessori, jumped in to help. The three of us could have pulled off a story on Hillary's paid speeches in time for dinner had it not been for the Russians. Earlier that afternoon, U.S. intelligence agencies said the Russians had been behind the DNC hack. Earlier today, the U.S. government removed any reasonable doubt that the Kremlin has weaponized WikiLeaks to meddle in our election and benefit Donald Trump's candidacy, the campaign said in a statement. The report confirmed what Brooklyn had been screaming about since Philadelphia. Putin was interfering in the election to hurt Hillary and help Trump. The report didn't say anything about Podesta's emails. At the same time, Clinton aides, Podesta haters mostly, and there were a lot, cautioned me not to believe the Russia spin. They said it could have been the Chinese. Or they asked how Podesta, a former White House advisor who had published a study on cybersecurity in 2014, could have used a Gmail account with no two-step verification. Maybe it was, as Trump said, somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds. But the campaign insisted the hack had been part of the same sophisticated misinformation campaign and warned us that the emails could have been doctored. I confirmed that the Wall Street speech excerpts were legit. I'd suspected they were. They sounded like Hillary. Not the Hillary I heard on the trail, but the real Hillary. The one who charmed donors in the Hamptons and reassured a party in Martha's Vineyard that the finance industry wasn't the enemy. The one who was witty, advising Lloyd Blankfein, the Goldman Sachs CEO, that if he wanted to run for office, he should leave and start running a soup kitchen somewhere. She was unencumbered by political correctness, saying the Dodd-Frank financial regulatory bill she lauded on the trail had been passed purely for political reasons. I remembered what Bernie asked Pete D'Alessandro when he first hired him in Iowa in 2015. Do you understand my politics? And how I'd struggled to answer that question about Hillary. There, in a January 25th, 2016 email titled HRC Paid Speeches, sent by the campaign's research director, Tony Kark, as flags to Podesta et al., and leaked to the world via Julian Assange, was my answer. In 2014, Hillary said her lifestyle made her kind of far removed from the growing sense of anxiety and even anger in the country over the feeling that the game is rigged. She cited backroom deal-making used by Abraham Lincoln and mused on the necessity of having both a public and private position on politically sensitive issues. In these speeches, she didn't sound like a progressive who likes to get things done, but a smart, savvy technocrat at home among the global elite. Hillary lamented, there is such a bias against people who have led successful and/or complicated lives. She said, my dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders, a comment, in the context of clean energy, that drew a couple more, oh my gods, from the politics pod. We huddled with editors to discuss how to proceed. Hillary's refusal to release the speeches had been such a cause célèbre in the primary that I regularly saw protesters holding signs that said, I'd rather be at home reading your Goldman Sachs speeches. Now, the juicy excerpts of the most sought-after trove of documents in the election had landed in our laps. But it wasn't a scoop, more like a bank heist. I never told anyone this, but one time when I'd been visiting the Brooklyn campaign headquarters, I found an iPhone in the ladies' room. I wasn't sure, but it seemed to belong to Podesta's assistant because when I picked it up, a flood of calendar alerts for Podesta popped up. I placed it on the sink counter, went into the stall, came out, and washed my hands. I had the sense that someone was watching, like those kids in the famous experiment told not to eat the marshmallows. I left the phone sitting there, worried that if I turned it and even touched it again, aides would think I had snooped. This seemed a violation that would at best get my invitation to the Brooklyn headquarters rescinded, and at worst get me booted off the beat for unethical behavior. I can't explain why, in the heat of breaking news, I thought covering Podesta's hacked emails was any different. The debate in the politics pod, with Carolyn's all-powerful whiteboard hovering to one side, a camouflaged Sarah Palin bobblehead, a few leftover bags of Fritos, my Windy for Texas sign, for irony, displayed on my desk, and the Access Hollywood video open on most of our screens, went something like this. What if burglars had broken into Brooklyn and stolen these off Podesta's desk? Would we cover them? True, these were stolen, but it's different. They're already out there. Is it different? I think so. It's not like if we don't write about them, no one will. True, they're already all over the place. And she could have just released the transcripts a long time ago. I checked the time. 5:37 p.m. I just wanted to write the story and get out of the office. After all those months of controversy, Hillary's Wall Street speeches weren't the main news of the day. If you haven't picked this up by now, Hillary was rarely the main news of the day. The desk was chaotic, reporters and editors overwhelmed. We had a Trump Access Hollywood package that included two stories, one news analysis, a story about GOP reaction, two videos, two annotated transcripts, and a sidebar about Billy Bush. Then there was the hurricane and a separate story by my D.C. colleagues on the Russian hacking. The desk slotted the speech story, which on any other day would have run on page one above the fold, at 1,200 words in the vitamin pages. Everyone agreed that since the emails were already out there and of importance to voters, it was the Times' job to confirm and contextualize them. I agreed. I didn't argue that it appeared the emails were stolen by a hostile foreign government that had staged an attack on our electoral system. I didn't push to hold off on publishing them until we could have a less harried discussion. I didn't raise the possibility that we'd become puppets in Putin's shadowy campaign. I chose the byline. I always chose the byline. In some twisted way, I put bylines ahead of my husband, my friends, my inner voice that told me not to look at that cell phone. We didn't know that for the remaining 31 days of the election, WikiLeaks would dump a new batch daily and that we'd spend the rest of the campaign contextualizing hashtag Podesta emails and living in fear that our own incriminating email exchanges would come out in the next pile. In the end, I co-wrote six stories and one blog post off the hacked emails. Two of those stories ran on the front page. Six out of the 1,285 stories I wrote on the Hillary beat for the Times. The stories weren't all negative. One of them made Chelsea a heroine who cleaned up her family's foundation, even if Doug Bann called her a brat. Another listed Hillary's Veep list. And yet there is no way around it. Their existence tainted my entire body of work. In December, after the election, my colleagues in D.C. wrote a Pulitzer-winning story about how the Russians had pulled off the perfect hack. I was on the F train on my way to the newsroom. I had no new beat yet and still existed in a kind of post-election haze that took months to lift. I must have read this line 15 times. Every major publication, including the Times, published multiple stories citing the DNC and Podesta emails posted by WikiLeaks, becoming a de facto instrument of Russian intelligence. I'd been called a cunt and a donkey-faced whore and a Hillary shill, but nothing hurt worse than my own colleagues calling me a de facto instrument of Russian intelligence. The worst part was, they were right. The Times columnist David Leonhardt put it best when he wrote, "The overhyped coverage of the hacked emails was the media's worst mistake in 2016, one sure to be repeated if not properly understood." I felt bad leaving Michael and Nick at the office that night so I could make it to the concert, but it was almost 8:30 and Bobby texted me from outside the Gramercy Theater. "Where are you?" "Go, go, we can finish things here," Michael said. I sat in the darkened theater. Bobby wore his khaki raincoat, the one he was wearing when I first picked him up in the Irish pub a decade earlier. He gave me the aisle seat. We held hands, but my mind was elsewhere. For years, I'd listened to a few minutes of Isbell's rueful lyrics to calm my nerves, at my desk on deadline, or while driving Beast from Iowa City to Ottumwa on dark farm roads. Now Isbell stood, black blazer against a bare-bones stage. I hadn't been in such an intimate venue, so engrossed by acoustic guitar since Austin, when all I wanted was to leave, to move to New York, and to become a journalist. I closed my eyes and let his bluesy vocals fill me. "Everything you built, that's all for show, goes up in flames, in 24 frames." Chapter 48, The Big Ball of Ugly. October 2016. Hillary hardly had time to watch the video when her phone started to ring. Friends and advisors urged her to make calls from Chappaqua. Every faith leader, every family values Republican, female executives, activists rallied them all in shared outrage. But she didn't. How could she? She was married to Bill. Hillary remembered what happened the year before, right around Christmas, when she'd kicked the crazy bear. Trump remembered, too. He knew his womanizing, or worse, would come out. But he'd effectively turned Bill Clinton into a human shield. Trump dismissed his comments in the video as locker room banter, adding, "Bill Clinton has said far worse to me on the golf course, not even close." In the months since Hillary began her campaign, Roger Ailes was ousted from Fox News after widespread claims of sexual harassment. Bill Cosby was accused of drugging and raping women. Brock Turner, a former Stanford University student found guilty of sexual assault, received a paltry 6-month jail sentence. A Columbia University student carried a 50-pound mattress around to protest the school's handling of her rape allegation. After the Access Hollywood video came out, more women came forward saying Trump had sexually harassed them. "I wanted Hillary, the first female nominee for president and a feminist icon, to be the collective voice of a nation on the verge of a cathartic scream." Instead, in those early days after the video hit and allegations mounted against Trump, Hillary mostly talked about cat videos. Now it makes you want to turn off the news, it makes you want to unplug the internet or just look at cat gifs, she said at a fundraiser in San Francisco when the subject of Trump and women came up. "Believe me, I get it. In the last few weeks, I've watched a lot of cats do a lot of weird and interesting things. But we have a job to do, and it will be good for people and for cats." Michelle Obama, a first lady untainted by sexual scandal, said what Hillary couldn't. "I can't believe I'm saying that a candidate for president of the United States has bragged about sexually assaulting women," Michelle said, placing her hand over her heart as a crowd of young women in New Hampshire watched in silence. "I can't stop thinking about this. It has shaken me to my core." In the standard political playbook, Hillary's impulse made sense. The Times upshot predicted that her lead was insurmountable. She should sit back and let her opponent implode. Still, I wanted to see Beijing Hillary. I wanted to see Wellesley Bullhorn Hillary. I wanted to see the Hillary who defended her health care plan to the House Committee on Ways and Means as a mother, a wife, a daughter, a sister, a woman, and then compared Republican Representative Dick Armey to Dr. Kevorkian. "The reports of your charm are overrated, and the reports of your wit are understated," Armey replied. The Hillary I definitely did not want to see was the one who pivoted to a safe list of Democratic constituencies. "It's more than just the way he degrades women, as horrible as that is," she often said. "He has attacked immigrants, African Americans, Latinos, people with disabilities, POWs, Muslims, and our military." She might as well have added Diet Coke drinkers to the list. Brooklyn kept complaining that the press cared more about the Access Hollywood video than the Russian meddling. They did this whole woe-is-me act about what bad luck they had, that the multiple intelligence agencies had released their report on Russian hacking on the same day as the Access Hollywood video. The spin had only one sensible response. "Give me a fucking break." Clinton allies had tried for months to unearth damaging video or audio from Trump's reality TV years. In private, Robbie didn't really care about the Russians. He thought Hillary should focus on the economy rather than try to explain to voters some convoluted intelligence report about a cyber attack. There was no question that a foreign adversary attacking our democracy was the more significant news story, and the media, myself included, should have given it more attention. But in terms of winning an election with a month to go, grab 'em by the pussy was a slam dunk. The daily hashtag Podesta email stories weren't helpful to Hillary, and I hated being summoned back to the newsroom to write them. But they mostly got buried in the vitamin pages as story after story on Pussygate and its implications for Trump landed on page one. In private, Trump's antics tore at Hillary. How could they not? On Thursday, she took a break from debate prep to have lunch in Manhattan with about 100 donor friends at the St. Regis, cost $33,400 to $250,000. Meryl Streep introduced Hillary and wove a narrative yarn about standing up to bullies. Trump had ended the first debate with a warning. I was going to say something extremely rough to Hillary, to her family, and I said to myself, I can't do it. It's inappropriate. It's not nice. Hillary knew what he meant. The word rape had already come up in debate prep sessions. When Merrill sat down, Hillary took a sip of water and reminisced at length about another debate preparation session, the one when she was in the 10th grade at Maine South High School in Park Ridge. The debaters were boys, juniors and seniors, some of them bulky football players who had no time for the overachieving blonde. But one football player stood out, Hillary said, her voice cracking. He opened the old bifurcated window of the classroom overlooking a courtyard where other students ate lunch and socialized. As Hillary tried to make her case, he broke off a rod that kept the windows hinged together and thrust it downward into the courtyard like a spear, a show of strength and intimidation that stayed with her. 50 years had gone by, but Hillary recalled the afternoon with such vivid detail that she started to sound as though she wasn't addressing donors at all, but giving herself a stream of consciousness pep talk. Too bad only 100 rich people got to hear it. I didn't go to the second debate, or the one after that. The reporters who wrote the main stories typically watched from the newsroom. Before the second debate, we turned up the volume on CNN to watch Trump as he sat down for an impromptu press conference with three women, Paula Jones, Juanita Broderick, and Kathleen Wiley, who accused Clinton of sexual harassment or sexual assault, and one woman, Kathy Shelton, who at age 12 was raped by a man Hillary defended at a trial in Arkansas in 1975. I had a hard time watching. The accusations in Roger Stone's book, deemed too salacious and unsubstantiated for us to write about a year earlier, now dominated the election. Stone always made the case that this wasn't just about Bill, but about how Hillary and her liberal friends had treated his accusers, a sexual assault swift boat campaign designed to chip away at Hillary's biggest advantage, her standing among women voters. She's not a victim, she was an enabler, Trump told Fox News. During the primary, Stone's whisper campaign started to filter down to young women who grew up with the mantra that every woman who accuses a man of sexual assault deserved to be believed. Before the Iowa caucuses, I'd written a piece about this generational divide among women. I heard that Lena Dunham, one of the campaign's top celebrity supporters, told a Park Avenue dinner party that she'd been disturbed by accusations that the Clintons and their allies dismissed and discredited these women. Hillary and the 1990s scandals, one feminist activist told me, was a big ball of ugly. Hillary erupted after the piece, angry I'd written about the Lena anecdote, which her publicist said had been mischaracterized, and quoted other young women wrestling with the issue. Even my most sympathetic Brooklyn sources told me that they understood why Hillary had been so disappointed in me, adding that they were sad about the state of the times. I didn't know what to think. It had been a different era in 1992 when Clinton campaign aides used words like bimbo and floozy and stalker to describe Bill's accusers. I once called Carville to confirm that he made the comment, if you drag a $100 bill through a trailer park, you never know what you'll find. His only complaint was that earlier reports mischaracterized the remark. I was talking about Jennifer Flowers, not Paula Jones. Got it. But blaming a wife for her husband's transgressions also seemed like the ultimate act of sexism. Show me the wife who, when she finds out her husband is having an affair with a much younger woman, says, "Oh, I feel such sisterhood with her," Katha Pollitt, the feminist poet and columnist for The Nation, told me. And if these women had been violated by Bill and smeared by the Clintons and their liberal friends, weren't they being abused all over again now, trotted out like sexual assault show ponies as 66.5 million Americans settled in to watch the second debate? A reporter at the press conference yelled out, "Mr. Trump, did you touch women without their consent?" And Paula Jones shot back in her Arkansas drawl, "Why don't y'all ask Bill Clinton that? Why don't y'all ask Bill Clinton that?" We predicted Trump's moves would backfire, that his bullying would lead to one of those times when the country saw Hillary's inner strength, like in the 2000 Senate raid when Rick Lazio stalked towards Hillary's lectern, insisting she sign a pledge against soft money, Or in the same debate when the moderator, Tim Russert, asked Hillary how voters could trust her after she'd sworn in a TV interview that her husband had not had an adulterous liaison in the White House. Her eyes welled up. Her lips tightened. Hillary replied, "I didn't mislead anyone. I didn't know the truth, and there's a great deal of pain associated with that." Michael Barbaro and I spent all afternoon